Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $20 on the Steel MS-162 or MS-170 chainsaw. Real Steel. Offer valid through June 30th, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Just like that, second hour is here. Hot Mike, Hutton and Withrow here at outkick.com/watch. Glad you're with us. You can find us post-show at YouTube. Just subscribe by searching out Outkick. Also, plenty of podcasts available, Jack.
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, you can subscribe, follow, download, whatever you need to do to listen to the show. If you don't want to look at our faces, you can always listen to us there.
Everyone loves looking at the face of Dane Bradshaw.
Yes,
Who joins us now.
This is the only reason people are tuning in today, to see Dane's face. That's it. Right.
Dane, good to see you, man. Hope things
haircut,
are well.
Man. Jeez. Oh, yeah, I need a haircut.
You'll have it for the Final Four, won't you?
You and Hutton have very similar hair. I feel like yours a little bit more curlier, I think, than Hutton's, but very, very similar in the hair department.
Dane, are you like me? I don't like it when it's curly. Do you?
No, it gets a little long, but yeah, I'm with you. But okay. And it didn't used to be this curly, so I don't know. I'll just thank God that I still got a little bit as I continue to age.
Well, Chad, hang on. Withrow loves us with curly hair. Apparently,
I do. I do love the curly hair. You know who doesn't have curly hair? Eric Musselman.
No,
does not have curly hair. That was the only segue I could figure way out of it. But reports coming down, Dane, that Eric Musselman is interviewing for the job at USC. When I see a report like that, that's always crazy to me to think about a sitting head coach at a place like Arkansas when there's a report that they're interviewing somewhere and not, you know, expected to take the job or anything else. That's sort of alarming to me. What did you make of that report?
I'm not totally surprised. Now, I didn't see that job opening happening with Andy Enfield leaving USC, but once it did, boy, it had Eric Musselman written all over it, because everyone knows he's a West Coast guy. He's done extremely well at Arkansas. You could feel and sense the tension this year that, they weathered the storm as best they could, and they didn't quit on the season. Those guys hung in there, but it wasn't the season they wanted. And I just I wouldn't be surprised at all if he took that job. And it seems like when you look at some of the rumors coming out of Arkansas, like the AD has said, look, we've stepped up in years past. We've given you extensions and raises. And look, Eric Musselman has been a home run hire. This wasn't the year they wanted, but he's been sensational at Arkansas. They had pretty much immediate success. And for the last couple of years, been the last SEC team standing in the NCAA tournament prior to this year. So, with that said, even when Eric Musselman got the job, I always wondered, all right, how long is he going to be there? That's not a knock on him by any means. You just wondered, all right, is this going to be the place that he retires or spends 10 to 15 years? Him being a West Coast guy and this job opportunity coming up, if anything, especially if USC offers it to him, to me, if it's equal to or even less than, I just think I could see him being ready for a change, and not only in jobs, but also location.
So, Dane, we keep hearing about from analysts all over the place that it's difficult to officiate Zach Edey because of his size and because of his style. Do you buy that with him, that it's difficult to officiate him? Do you think officials across college basketball are doing a good job officiating him in Purdue?
I think he can be tough to officiate, and some of that, maybe it's not a fair comparison, but like Shaq, it's more of, hey, a guy is just completely leaning into the big man with all his might and he's not moving. Is that a foul or not on the opponent? I think that's probably the tougher part to do. Now, maybe I'm Tennessee biased like you, haven't watched that game. I thought they missed a few that weren't difficult to officiate, and when you see, when you see an arm bar go out as an opponent is jumping for a rebound and they get pushed underneath the basket, I don't care if you're Zach Edey or Zakai Ziegler, that's typically a play that's getting blown on the offense there for a push in the back. I don't think that's why they lost the game. I think Zach Edey has made himself less foul prone probably this year. I didn't study him closely that much last year, but his speed and his agility is impressive because, yes, he camps out down low in the paint. And yes, there's frustration. Is he in there for 3 seconds or more? How do you get him out there? But he's also pretty agile. He'll sprint up to the top of the key, set some really good ball screens that you don't expect a 7'4" guy to go up there under control and be solid on that. I know there was one where Ziegler clipped his hip that everybody thought should have been a foul. But for the most part, even though Purdue didn't have many scores outside of him, when those other guys did get a good ball screen from him, man, it was straight line drives to the basket by him being able to get out there on the perimeter. So really impressed by him. Difficult cover. I know that's not the question was more about the officiating, but I can't say that was the reason Tennessee lost.
Well, in 3 seconds, it's one of those things that there are a few things in college basketball now that I'm not even sure if it's still a rule. Carrying the ball at times in games is never called. The dribble handoff moving screen is a new thing in college basketball that I watch Alabama play. You could call every trip down when they're doing the dribble handoff because the guy just keeps running into someone and sets a moving screen at that point. And the other one's 3 seconds with Edie, which I know it's not every time down that he has it, but there are times your colleague Jimmy Dykes pointed this out, 4, 5, 6, 7 seconds, he will be in the lane. What do you have a problem with a 3 second violation not getting called?
I do. And I think most bigs are pretty mobile to where they get a feel and they get, you know, outside the lane, then repost. And Edie was pretty good at that too. If he didn't get it as deep as he wanted to, he'd kick it out and then back you down to where he got better post position. And that's one of those things. Look, as a coach, sometimes I think this was, I hesitate to say if it was the same exact thing, but I believe it was Calipari before a game when they were playing a very physical team that does a ton of offensive rebounding. And man, they will just steal down low in the post and they will clear out space. And it's kind of one of those illegal picks down low as well. A really physical team they were preparing for. And the message to his team a little bit was, hey guys, I want y'all to do it. And I wanted you to get called for it. Because if the ref calls it on you, they better call it on the other team, which is a huge part of their offense. And so I say this somewhat sarcastically, but if it was that big of an issue and Rick Barnes and his staff were like, hey, man, this is wrong, do you go tell Awaka, sit down there in the paint, do exactly what they're doing. I don't care if we get a turnover. I want to see them blow their whistle for 3 seconds so that we can demand they call it that way on the other end of the rest of the game. Or do you risk losing some points, getting a technical and saying, by God, I'm going to get a tech that's going to cost us a point and maybe the ball. But at the same time, that's going to make the referees more aware of their count and Edie not getting that position. But, you know, Edie's pretty darn good even when he's not catching it in the paint. So I'm not sure that would have solved all the problems.
Dave Bradshaw with us, SEC Network. How much fun is it to watch DJ Burns? I mean, it's a blast. And what matchup, how do you see this matchup going this weekend on Saturday between NC State, Purdue, and the fact that, well, DJ Burns is going up against Edie?
Yeah. It has been awesome to watch and the journey that kid has had. If you watch, I remember the first thing Rick Barnes ever said about him when I saw him at practice as a freshman, I guess he redshirted that year. And you can see it on the court. He's got one arm longer than the other. Like I think it's the left arm that's shorter than the other, but I'm telling you, watch the game. You'll see him going up and down the court. And okay, once he stands still, you'll see it's about a hand's length longer. But anyway, there's your fun fact bar bet that you can win some money on. But, anyway, to see his journey has been really cool, and the NC State story has been remarkable. I'd be shocked if the Cinderella story continues, though. I'm not seeing the semifinal games being that great. I think the finals game will be terrific. Purdue, UConn, all respect to NC State, Alabama. I think the top teams prevail, and we get a heck of a matchup. So, but if anything, I think Alabama might be able to hang in a little bit longer than NC State.
Yeah, and with Alabama, I agree with you, Dane. I feel like UConn should handle them, but I also know that Alabama always has that shooter's chance because they're going to shoot such a high volume amount of three-pointers that if Mark Sears hits 7 in a row the way he did in the second half against Clemson, maybe they can hang around and give themselves a chance. Is that really the only formula for Alabama, just to hope that they're on fire from three to have a chance against UConn?
That is a huge part of it, because they've struggled with defense and toughness all season long. Now they are coming on with the mentality of better late than never. And I laughed when Nate Oates said, we got back to playing defense. He said, well, that's probably a bad word. We didn't get back to playing defense because we hadn't played defense all year. Yeah. We've started playing defense. And so if they can do that at an average to good level, they'll give themselves a chance. But I applaud Nate Oates for what he's done. Entire staff turnover, roster turnover. When I look at this team, I don't look at it as, you know, you can maybe argue it's his third most talented team he's had at Alabama, yet here they're on the Final Four. And by no means am I taking anything away from them. But the teams that they've been able to beat to get here, and they put on a show against North Carolina, that was the one that they had to beat a higher seed in. I just don't know that, despite how confident they're playing, that's going to translate against to arguably the best team in the country with UConn, because UConn, they're so tough. They play so well defensively. And most of the times those teams aren't as efficient on the offensive end. Yeah, many coaches will tell you can't be great at everything. Well, UConn might be the exception to that. They're pretty darn good at everything.
Dane, you mentioned John Calipari a moment ago. It's a weird spot right now for the Kentucky program. I don't know if this is a lame duck situation with him coming back, if there's going to be a rejuvenation of the spirit of that program with another great recruiting class coming in. Mitch Barnhart didn't seem all that excited with the announcement that he was coming back for another year. Well, what do you make of where that program is after another disappointing NCAA tournament?
Yeah, a lot of tension and divide there with the fan base and the coaching staff. And when you came into this year, it felt good though. It felt like you were not only getting a rejuvenated Coach Calipari with this freshman class, but the modernization of their offense with the 3-point shooting, faster style of play that the fans were saying, there we go. That's what we've been saying we want. And Cal being able to say, well, look, we've got the personnel now to do that. But they said, look, let's not argue about whether you had it before or not. We're just glad you're doing it. And so you had some of the fan base and the likable personalities on the team and all that coming together, in addition to a little bit of a redemption tour for Coach Calipari, to where everybody's happy. Coach gets to redeem himself. Fans get to have a little bit of, hey, this is the offense we're looking for. Nobody's got to say, I told you so. Just go advance in the NCAA tournament. We'll let bygones be bygones. But that didn't happen. And so now you're back to, in a lot of ways, where you were last year of saying, all right, if we were too old last year and you want new, young, talented guys and you take talent over maturity, we've tried that. And now we're young and we need experience over that. Well, we tried that too. And so Kentucky fans are kind of putting their hands up in there saying, all right, when are we going to get the right blend to allow us to advance better in March? And I think they can, but you know, the league has gotten so much tougher, and it's not just about the league, but at the same time, it's getting harder to get that one or two seed that you would like to have at Kentucky, because the SEC is going to come with 5-6 losses a year for Kentucky the way they're built right now.
Dane, thank goodness, like last year's Final Four, we had FAU and San Diego State meet up in the Final Four, and then one would advance, right? Like I'm thankful. I do want to see UConn and Purdue. Like I want to hit the fast forward button. I'm hoping that there's not an upset. With that in mind, though, the storylines for both teams, if we get there, we probably won't talk to you until after the championship game. The amount of just pressure, but also the difficulty level of running it back. This will be the first time if UConn does it since Florida did it in 2007. Explain for the average fan how difficult it is to do that in today's era of college basketball, and what we saw in last year's tournament, for instance, with the FAUs of the world making the runs that they did.
Yeah, it is. And what UConn is doing is sensational. It'd be something that I didn't think we'd ever see, not only just the back-to-back, but how dominant they're being in the NCAA tournament, where they're winning games night in, night out. double digits. The 30-0 run that they did in the Elite Eight, that you sit there and say, all right, maybe you do a 30-0 run when you're playing, you know, the second game of the year against a cupcake team that you're paying $100,000 to come get whooped, but not in the Elite Eight. And Florida's back-to-back was a little bit different. They struggled more during the regular season. They had returners coming back. So you had sort of the same roster. This is, while UConn's the same program, not necessarily the same roster. And so both equally phenomenal. But, you could argue with UConn that it's even more difficult because you got new players, NIL era and all those things, and how dominant they've been. Now, they don't have it yet, so they still got to win a couple more. But, yeah, it's especially in college basketball and March Madness, as you guys know, the best team doesn't always win in advance. It's just how it goes. If it was a round of three, round of five, round of seven, UConn, you probably are expecting to see them there. But to see them just continue to dominate, not have an off night, for now two consecutive NCAA tournaments, has been nothing short of sensational.
And then from Purdue's perspective, the embarrassment of last season, losing in round one, and for Matt Painter, having them lock in and do what they've done. I mean, we've seen Virginia do it. But from Purdue's perspective, with Zach Edey, the back-to-back National Player of the Year, you've got the storylines of both sides and what Purdue can accomplish to correct the wrongs of last year with the pressure that they had and the ridicule that they faced, with another pressure-packed season that they could overcome here.
Yeah, it's a great point, because for Purdue, you got to think as a player's perspective, no matter how much you're playing to win, in those situations, you feel the monkey on your back. You know you're trying to break through to the first Final Four and what, since 1980, I believe it was for them.
Yep.
And so it's the opportunities to have that here we go again mindset throughout the NCAA tournament that they've avoided, really, to allow that negativity to insert their mind or insert or influence their execution. You got to give them all the credit in the world. And now that they're in the Final Four, it's not really the you win a game, you feel a sense of relief. Now they're just, man, they're not only playing confident, but they're playing free with joy. I'm not going to say nothing to lose, because they're still going to be the favorite. But, man, they've done something nobody else has done in 44 years. So you certainly go out there with less pressure, even though the stakes have never been higher. And that's a huge competitive advantage for them.
Are you guys surprised? I'm surprised, coming off of last year's tournament and the parity that we did see, that throughout the season, you know, the number one team would lose quite often and back and forth, that at the end of this, we still have UConn and Purdue, much like we had throughout the entire regular season. I would not have predicted that based on last year's tournament.
Nothing surprised me, though, Dane, when you consider, to me, UConn, Purdue, Houston were clearly the top three teams, right, of those number one seeds all year. There was a battle for that fourth number one seed. But if it's those two, to me, to answer that question, that's the least surprising thing about this tournament if we end up UConn versus Purdue.
Yeah, and Houston certainly could have been in there with until Shed got hurt. But I think it was, to your point, though, I think it was in the Sweet 16 where at that point it was the lowest total in terms of seeding.
Yeah.
That we had in several years. And so there weren't as many Cinderella stories. I don't know if some of that is, because these top programs are getting older, you're retaining more talent to where you're getting some of these veteran guys able to close out games. I really don't know. But those teams have separated themselves. They got a chance to back it up. And as much as I love a Cinderella story, honestly, I cheer for the best team to go finish it off. They've earned it, and to play their best basketball, because it's a nightmare to sit there and be like, man, what could have been? We lost to a team that wasn't as good as us, and we just didn't play that well that night. And NC State has proven that to plenty of teams, knocking them off, what, 9 straight elimination games? That's just unheard of. And I'm with you. I'd like to see Purdue and UConn, because as much as I'm high on UConn, I'm not ready to just say it. It's theirs for the taking.
So that would be a great game. I mean, that's how I view it too. I I took Purdue, though, in my bracket, so I'm all Boilermaker. You got Purdue or UConn?
And I want to just see, like, I want to see this great UConn defense. I'm just curious to see, because I haven't followed, you know, Big Ten all year long necessarily the way right. I do the SEC. Just national championship game, or NC State might show us as well. But, all right, what do you try to do on Edie? Do you take the Tennessee route where it's you don't mix up coverages too much? It's just going to be make the other guys shut those guys down. Edie might get his. Do you try to front some? Heck, do you start with two guys on him and just say, hey, we're putting two guys on him at one time, and we're going to make you play 4-on-3 against the rest of us? I don't know. And I'm sure there's not just one answer, but I'm just curious to see. In a national championship game, do you sit there and play behind and let them go to work for 40? Or what UConn would do, being one of the top defenses in the nation?
Yeah, a big rating whenever we see that matchup.
Let's just hope it's UConn and Purdue,
exactly.
And not Alabama.
Let's hope they're not looking ahead the way we are.
If we're talking about the matchups and strategy and what they're going to do against Edie, I just hope it's UConn we're talking about using that strategy against Edie. Dane, thanks so much,
man. Thank you, Dane.
Always great having you on, buddy.
Thank you, guys. Anytime.
He's the man. Dane Bradshaw, SEC Network. Follow him on social.
Give me UConn and Purdue. I'm with them early on. We love the upsets. When I get to the Sweet 16, Elite Eight, Final Four, I like chalk. I like knowing these are the best two teams throughout the year that are playing for a national title. I think that's what we're going to get if it's UConn and Purdue.
DJ Burns getting looks, not just from the paint, not just from the block, but another league altogether, different sport.
That's not the WNBA.
Not the WNBA.
Okay, good.
But there are some that think if he wanted to play there, he could, Jeff. No boundaries.
No boundaries.
No boundaries.
Just like Reggie Miller said, no
That's
boundaries.
Right. That's next. You're on Hot Mic. Hot Mic with Hunter Withrow. Outkick.com is where you can find us streaming live each and every day. Outkick.com/watch. Post show, clips, highlights, and more on our YouTube page. Just search Outkick. We hope you subscribe while you're there. Chad, the offensive line play in the NFL has been down, right?
Yes.
When we watch DJ Burns,
the defense has the advantage.
Oh, yeah. And the investment is now going on the defensive line. It's been at the defensive end. Now it's being the money's being shoveled in on the inside and the interior. DJ Burns, according to a report, DJ Burns is getting attention from NFL teams. Now, this wouldn't be the first time we've seen basketball translate to the gridiron. We've seen that at tight end, right? The athletic tight end, more of a receiver than a blocker.
Antonio Gates is the most high-profile example.
Yes,
but there, did not play college football.
There have been many over the years since then. This, according to Peter Schrager, NFL teams expressing interest in taking a look at him for offensive linemen, specifically tackle, because of just how quick he is, the footwork, the athleticism for his size.
He's a ballerina.
So he's listed at 6'9". The estimate would be he's probably 6'7", and a point something. But I mean, there's big money there. And for Burns, do you give it a look? Do you play it out? Because it's hard to find offensive linemen or defensive linemen that are 6'9" in the NFL. Normally, the biggest offensive lineman will be around 6'7". 6'6". On the defensive side, also hard to find the towering big men. So if he's closer to 6'7", I think that lends well to him. He's got the athleticism. He's got the athleticism. What's he like in pads? Don't know. But I can say that there are some really bad offensive linemen in the NFL
that are slow. He's listed as 6'9", 275.
Yep.
Zion Williamson is listed at 6'6", 284. So Zion Williamson is supposedly 3 inches shorter
and something he's
and
heavier
10
than
pounds
that.
Heavier than DJ Burns. I look at DJ Burns and I feel like he's much bigger, heavier than Zion Williamson even. Maybe that's not the case. I don't think DJ Burns would have a hard time putting on the weight if they needed him to. You don't see a lot of tackles in the NFL at 275. So if that's true, he'd need to add weight. I also am not positive he's only 275. So an NFL team would have to look at that. Look, if anybody's got the footwork, athleticism, all of that to make it happen and translate, it's probably someone like DJ Burns. I've long said basketball players are the best athletes. It's a sport that translates when you look at their height, weight,
yes.
speed, jumping ability, quickness, everything else. If you were going to take a high-level NBA player and let it translate to another sport, it's easier to do that than even with a high-level football player, baseball player. And there are exceptions to that rule, absolutely. But maybe DJ Burns would be the exception to it, where he could learn a position like offensive line relatively quickly.
Take a flyer.
And be effective at it. Sure. I mean, I would look at it if I were an NFL team.
Why can't he translate to the next level for basketball? Watches. I mean, he's got the size and the power, but yeah, the finesse as well, the finish. It just smooth. It's fun to watch because of his size paired with the way he can move.
Well, his future, he hopes, is in basketball. But if that doesn't work out,
yeah.
I love NFL teams that are creative and that are looking underneath every possible stone. And this would be an example of that. If there's a team that's legitimately interested in putting some pads on DJ Burns and seeing what he looks like on a football field, I'd be all for it.
The best athletes now are going to the defensive line across football.
I'd be all for it.
Rashee Rice is in the middle of not just a car accident, but a legal battle now. He's got an attorney speaking for him after this car wreck where he's driving the Chevy Corvette, high rates of speed. And a dash cam caught this in what was a six-car pileup where he leaves. And according to his attorney, he's cooperating with authorities on this. But, Chad, this is just a growing... Add this to a list of not just this offseason, but what we're seeing in a trend across what seems like football with Georgia, you know, the storylines of last offseason and unfortunately and tragically the loss of life. And, you know, just going back to different Vegas incidents and other things, not good. The draft will overshadow all of the offseason this year.
Yeah,
but when you think about Cam Sutton, who was... he was wanted and for good reason, and he ends up turning himself in after what was just a bizarre search for him, where he's in the facility with the Lions and that they knew that he had a warrant out for him and they let him leave. And you have Vontae Davis, who's found dead in his home yesterday, the brother of Vernon Davis and a cornerback from the NFL. And Rashee Rice over the weekend in this incident. What the trend, while we have incidents every offseason, the trend of the speeding and the high rates of speed with the cars, that's something that is a part of a younger culture that I didn't grow up with.
I don't understand it. It does seem to be a football issue. It's definitely a University of Georgia football issue. I mean,
yeah.
So many incidents
litany
involving that where
issues.
Kirby Smart's having to talk about it as a trend and a thing with that program. I remember when the Mike Vick dogfighting thing broke out, it sort of illuminated this whole world of underground pit bull fighting that we didn't know about that seemed to be very prominent, right?
Yeah.
In parts of Virginia where he was having these dogfights.
Yeah.
And suddenly there were, you know, exposés done about it. 60 Minutes is there. There's documentaries about dogfighting. And it's something that kind of growing up in the South, Hutton, I would hear about. But I knew people who raised pit bulls, but I'd never been to a dogfight.
No.
I never knew anyone involved in it. I didn't know it was so prevalent. And then you hear about this whole underground world with it, with Mike Vick. I feel the same way now about road racing. That there's this whole world of road racing, street racing with cars that, you know, I thought was fiction from the Fast and Furious that apparently is a thing with football players everywhere.
Well, drag racing, like on the, you know, the strip growing up, like you would do that off the stoplight, right? Like you would see that or hear that, but not at the high rates of speed that we're seeing here.
No, and not in broad daylight on the interstate in Dallas.
And at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Where it's a 6 or 7 car pileup because of it.
Yeah, and the need to want to do that.
It's crazy.
Yes. The Big 12 postponing their efforts to head to Mexico. Big 12 Mexico delayed at least a year. The statement released by the Big 12. Today, Big 12 announced delayed the launch of Big 12 Mexico with a new target date of 2025. Since Big 12 Mexico was announced, a variety of major initiatives have been added to the conference's agenda, headlined by the onboarding of 4 new member institutions. The Big 12 will continue to build its brand in Mexico through its broadcast partners and remain enthusiastic about bringing the Big 12 to Mexico. this is opening the door for more revenue. That's how they view this. And they should take their time with this. We have seen the NFL try to break into the Mexico initiative. And what has happened? They've had field issues, stadium issues. With what they're trying to do in the Big 12, they should take their time as they expand to try to get more revenue, to stay relevant in a world that is diminishing around them.
I don't think this will ever work. And here's why.
Is it one game?
Here's why. Cross this over to anything in college sports. College sports is uniquely American. It is very popular in America. If you go anywhere else in the world and you present to them, hey, we've got this really good basketball product and we want you to watch it, the first response is, well, is the top level of basketball? Is it professional? No. Okay, I don't care. I think that is going to be the spirit of everywhere else in the world. In America, we love it. But if you try to translate that in other countries, the first question back is, am I seeing the top level of your sport in your country? If the answer is no, that's a tough sales pitch internationally.
But I think this is something they should try, because while it is uniquely American, Texas, Arizona, California uniquely transcend it when it comes to Mexico. And those markets, the NFL markets, are making money off of Mexico.
Yeah.
And the fans that will wear their gear, buy and support certain teams because of where they're located, and the whole aspect of just the history around those areas.
And the fans
that live in those states.
It's worth a try. It's worth the effort. But I'm just telling you, I believe that Mexican Americans living in Arizona or Dallas are going to be Arizona Cardinals fans and Dallas Cowboys fans.
Sure.
And they're not going to be Arizona Wildcat and Texas Longhorn fans, because it just doesn't translate. They're going to go for their football team and their football team. They're going to have their soccer team and the national team they're going to support, and then they're going to be Dallas Cowboys fans or Arizona Cardinal fans. I think it's a tough, tough sales job for them to make this
tough.
Work.
It's tough for the Big 12 to make
it
work, period.
I like the effort.
As a part of a Power Four. You know, it's if you're loading up on the East Coast, if you're the ACC, things are okay because of the TV deals and all that. The Big 12's trying to make that even more profitable for them. And that's something the Pac-12 couldn't do. The Pac-12 couldn't meet with the Big 12 on their media deal. And yeah. I mean, if there is one transcendent university or program they have, it's not in Mexico, but it's Colorado with Dion. That's the transcendent program that can break
now it is,
across
yeah.
state lines, I'm saying, with yeah. viewership. That's their marketing.
I think
arm.
if you're not trying, then you're not doing your due diligence.
I think that,
so I like the effort of the Big 12. I'm just giving you my opinion as to why I don't think it's ever going to work.
And I don't
to any great extent.
I actually think it's good to be patient with this instead of rushing it for 2024. It would be a mad dash to try to get this done and actually do something there this year. So I like the fact that they've at least hit the pause button here. We're on the move, though. We're on the bus, off the bus with Davey Hudson.
We are, guys, and actually it's crazy talking about this. As far as like some of the biggest migrant cities, I think we hit four of those. You were mentioning Colorado. Outside of the state of Texas, Denver is the biggest area as far as Mexican-Americans relocating.
Wow.
Or just Mexicans relocating inside the United States.
But is the Big 12 region?
Yeah, it is now. Yeah. Now that we've got all the realignment taking yeah. place. But, guys, we're going to start talking about the NFL a little bit earlier. In Detroit with the draft, we've had several conversations about how this first round is going to go at the end of this month. And the quarterback conversation is where all of the beginning as far as the top 10 picks, what's going to happen there. And for today, the first on the bus, off the bus, four quarterbacks will be drafted in the first five picks.
Chad, I'm off the bus with this. I don't think J.J. McCarthy is worth the haul it's going to take for teams to move up in the top five to Arizona or L.A. And I say that and I realize there's always a different price if you don't have a quarterback to go get one. And it's the quarterback draft and then there's the rest of the draft. But if in fact we see 1, 2, and 3 with where we have the top three quarterbacks go, I don't think if I'm Arizona, I'm getting enough in return for J.J. McCarthy to back out and pass on Marvin Harrison Jr. They're going to get a haul if it is McCarthy at four. But you're giving up on Marvin Harrison Jr. if you do that. If you get future picks, take it. I don't think you're going to get the type of trade we saw, for instance, with Houston and Cleveland, where Houston is set up with multiple picks moving forward for years. I don't see that type of price tag on J.J. McCarthy. Maybe I'm crazy. I'm thinking of it from Minnesota's angle. I just don't see J.J. McCarthy throwing bombs to Justin Jefferson. I don't visualize that, and because of that, I don't see four.
I'm off the bus for now. My mind can be changed on this, and it's like anything in draft coverage. The stories change, the reports change daily. So ask me a week from now, and maybe I'm buying into some report out there that the Vikings are willing to give up so much to trade up and get J.J. McCarthy, but right now I'm off the bus. Quarterbacks are going 1, 2, and 3, and there's going to be other players going 4 and 5 with no trade.
All right, guys. Speaking of J.J. McCarthy, my favorite thing going around on the internet right now is his highlight package, and all plays are just handoffs. But we are heading to Boulder, Colorado. And, you know, speaking of the top five, Deion Sanders said that he has 2 top 5 picks in next year's draft on his current team. And while the jury is still out on that, Deion Sanders will get Colorado to a bowl game this season.
I'm on the bus, and I think it is a necessity. I don't think media is putting enough pressure on Deion Sanders. Okay, this is a big offseason for him. I know that he brings ratings. I know that he's a great soundbite. I know that he gets people talking. And then when he goes on his own podcast and talks about Archie Manninging the draft next year for two of his players, one of them being his son, it's going to get a lot of talk. He needs to get to a bowl game. Like, the rubber is going to meet the road this year in year two. They got off to a great start. They should have been done better given the start they had than the way they just fell off a cliff last year. This is a team that even with the move to the Big 12 needs to make it happen this year. And looking at their schedule for the upcoming season, it's going to be tough. I mean, to get to 6 wins with this schedule is going to be very, very difficult. North Dakota State at Nebraska, at Colorado State, Baylor at UCF, Kansas State at Arizona, Cincinnati at Texas Tech, Utah at Kansas, Oklahoma State. Doable, but difficult. Got to get 6 wins, got to get to a bowl game. I'm on the bus. Hutton, I think he's going to get there.
Yeah, I'm on the bus as well. He's right there on the fringe, though, for me, of getting to a bowl game and taking them there, because he's got to have the TCU moment, which they're totally capable of. They showed us that last year. He can't have the Stanford moment, which they're totally capable of. They showed us last year. And if, in fact, you've got 2 of the top 5 picks in the NFL draft, you better get to a bowl game with that crew. Absolutely you should. They should be revamped on the offensive line as bad as they were last year. And Warren Sapp's going to make the difference, apparently. He's joining as a quality control coach or a is he an analyst, or I don't know how he qualifies.
He's technically listed as a grad assistant.
Grad assist. So he is on the field for game day. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah.
Like he's able to recruit? I don't know. Like
maybe Warren's going to put him over the top.
Maybe, yeah.
I'm with you. It's going to be razor's edge for them to get to a bowl. It's going to be a big moment right in late November when they win the game to get bowl eligible.
They are absolutely capable of having another TCU moment on a national stage. And it there needs to be more pressure on Deion. I don't think he minds that. I just wonder, what's the Rick George pressure from behind the scenes? I think it's the opposite. Deion gets what he wants, and the money talks. I don't know if the pressure will be on him from the networks because everyone's reaping the rewards of the Colorado Buffalo football program, which is still bizarre to say, given the fact that we're about 1.5 years removed from them being just the doldrums of college football.
Well, guys, if they get to a bowl game, they'll probably treat that like a championship, but sure. As far as actual championships, we're headed down to Phoenix because on Monday night, they play for all the marbles, and UConn repeating as national champions is inevitable.
I'm off the bus. Inevitable. The word inevitable. It's never that easy. There's going to be a test with Purdue. We're going to see that showdown. That's going to be a great game. Unless the officials all of a sudden start to call fouls against and on Zach Edey. That's the only way that UConn runs away with that game, Chad, in that moment. I think the classic championship game, and it's not inevitable that UConn wins it. It's inevitable that they're going to make it to the title game.
Not inevitable. They're certainly the favorite. I mean, they're averaging winning by 29 points per game after averaging 20 points per game a year ago. So UConn is the favorite. Definitely not inevitable. And I point simply to Zach Edey to say, I just saw a 7'4" guy score his career high in points with 40 in an Elite Eight game against a really good 2 seed who probably should have been a number 1 seed in winning a close game. So anything can happen. I'll also point to the fact that Purdue is the most efficient 3-point shooting team in the country. They did not shoot well from 3 against Tennessee. So if they get that part of their game going, where they're bombing in some open looks from 3 around Edey and he can go to work, they're going to be right there with a chance to beat UConn. I think UConn wins. That would be my pick right now from what I've seen, but definitely not inevitable. So I'm off the bus on
Davey,
this one, Davey.
Davey, you have the UConn winning, which means you'll win the bracket.
I'm all in on UConn. I even think they're going to make it to where they will have won 12 games by double digits in 2 straight NCAA tournaments.
Even against Purdue?
Even against Purdue.
They have not been tested, which is crazy.
But there's always a test.
I could see Alabama testing them. Only because Alabama's going to shoot enough threes that if they get just lucky hot in that game, they're going to test them.
I mean, the one caveat I could pull is that teams that are a 1 seed and lose to a 16 seed the year prior have won the national championship at 100% of the time. But, guys, we're going to end up in Los Angeles for our end of the line. And, you know, the MLB, they are doing their due diligence to look into Shohei Ohtani and the investigation. But the MLB will find no wrongdoing from Ohtani during the course of this investigation.
Totally on the bus. I feel like they're going to find this out in the next 24 hours. This is an open and shut case for the MLB. They do not want to find anything wrong with their golden boy. And they're not going to do any digging at all to find that. So regardless of what we think might be out there or unexplained questions, unanswered questions that we still have, not going to matter to Major League Baseball because it is in their best interest to pin this all on the degenerate gambler interpreter, which he was, by all accounts, that we can find. And there's other stories out there about him teaching other Japanese players how to work a casino when they were in town for spring training. They're going to try to pin all of it on him. None of it Ohtani. This is going to be open and shut. Quick, easy peasy. The golden boy survives. I'm on the bus.
I'm on the bus too, but because it's tough to pin him on anything right now. They shouldn't automatically try to. I'm in favor of them trying to find something that's not there either.
Oh no.
And while they're going to, they want to get this over. The fact that they want a swift investigation tells you that they're going to find it this way. What they better pray and hope for is that nothing else comes up and pops up with evidence showing that they did, in fact, just rush through it to find this result. That's where they're screwed, because they have the Pete Rose element towering over them, banned for life. And here's the Babe Ruth of our generation. And if that were to happen, how they would treat him and how the investigation would go, I mean, it's like Pete Rose said, maybe I should just
blame it on my interpreter.
Blame it on my interpreter.
He wishes he had.
I'm on the bus, Davey, but I'm on the bus because they're going to finish things before anything legally happens with the interpreter himself or the federal investigation into the illegal bookmaker. Major League Baseball should have their investigation wrapped up as soon as possible, but they shouldn't automatically look for something negative if it's not there. And by now, I mean, there's so much confusing information. Behind the scenes, I need to see both sides of this clear, and I still haven't. And so, therefore, yeah, they're going to find no wrongdoing because right now it's tough to point to anything that's been a wrongdoing from Ohtani's perspective.
I don't think the PR teams for either side, whether it's Ohtani's camp or the MLB, has done a good job, but I love this storyline. I think this is perfect for the sport.
Players can bet on anything other than diamond sports. That's not against baseball policy.
Right.
Now, it is against baseball policy to do this through a state that doesn't allow it or to do it with an illegal bookmaker anywhere. But to actually bet on basketball, or, you know, he's in the hockey jersey.
If you're in a state that allows it.
At the Anaheim game. Yeah. And you place money on that game. You can do that.
Which is the way it should be, I think.
Absolutely. That's the way it should. And it's just that's their policy, regardless of where you are in like the NFL. So wrongdoing would be betting on baseball. And that's going to be tough to find based on the illegal bookmaker aspect. Unless you're keeping a Rolodex of all these different bets and you actually don't just have the cash mechanism here. In this case, the money's wired. But there's got to be some type of money trail going back to Otani making the bet and not the other dude. That's going to be tough. Not like a camera's going to pick this up at a casino.
Right.
At a sports book. But yeah, they're going to find no wrongdoing.
Davey?
All right.
No wrongdoing, by the way, by a lot of players in the past from Major League Baseball.
That's right. Davey, great work. Good job. Guys, we got some breaking news.
Let's
here.
Let's hear it.
Iowa LSU. 4.9 million watch the second round game.
Yep.
6.9 million watch the Sweet 16 game. 12.3 million people watched the game last night. That is bigger than Tennessee-Purdue on Sunday with 10.4 million. That is bigger than 15 million was bigger. Duke and NC State also. So that was actually bigger, the men's game, than the women's.
And this is the overnight average?
12.3 million viewers on ESPN on Monday night, making the most watched NCAA women's basketball game ever. Last year's title game, 9.9 million on ABC and ESPN2. If Iowa plays South Carolina for the national championship game, that is going to be a gigantic number.
Well, so will UConn.
Well, UConn, Iowa is going to up that also. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the history of what UConn's done.
So this will be Sunday. Yeah. That's the off day for
Friday,
the men's tournament.
That's right.
So Saturday will be men's Final Four. Sunday will be women's Final Four.
Final Four, I believe, is it Friday that it gets underway in Cleveland?
No.
For the women's Final Four?
No. Sunday. Men's Final Four Saturday.
Tuesday?
Yeah. Women's Final Four Sunday. Men's National Championship game Monday. Women's National Championship game Tuesday. Unless they've changed the format. They'll play on Sunday.
Yeah, Friday, April 5th is, let's see here. South Carolina, NC State, UConn, Iowa. Friday, April 5th.
They're playing on a Friday?
Yeah, they're playing Friday in Cleveland.
For years, it was Sunday, Tuesday they would play.
So now they'll get the title game on Sunday?
So Friday night, and then that number's going to be gigantic, bigger than this one likely. And then if they're playing Sunday, it'll be
even bigger. They're playing Sunday. The championship's Sunday the 7th, this Sunday.
It'll be even bigger.
And they capitalize on, I mean, think about Caitlin Clark. They nearly lost earlier this postseason. They make it past that round. And who were they playing that? It was a Sweet 16 matchup, right?
This year?
Or the round of 32, yeah.
Whereas, round of 32, they played West Virginia. Sweet 16, they played Colorado.
West Virginia stuck very – it was 2 minutes left. It's a close game. Caitlin Clark advances. Then you get the matchup in the Elite Eight for the right to go to the Final Four, the rematch of the national title game with the rivalry that we've seen between Clark and Reese. And now to get to the title, you go through UConn, then likely South Carolina, who's been on top of the women's basketball mountain.
That game last night also the most watched game ever, regardless of gender, on ESPN for college basketball.
That's massive.
Biggest game in ESPN history for college basketball.
And you know what?
A women's game. Bigger than Tennessee-Purdue with 10.4 million.
And it goes to...
And not even that close.
And it goes to the rivalry. The hype.
It goes to Caitlin Clark.
Well, Caitlin Clark...
Because I think her number's only going to go higher even without Angel Reese this next round.
But Caitlin Clark's been on ESPN. She's been playing games. The Caitlin Clark Angel Reese rivalry has built up over the years. Caitlin Clark has absolutely benefited from Angel Reese's behind the scenes.
But
the off court talk.
Sure,
because it's been about Caitlin Clark.
Sure, but the next round's going to be even bigger.
Sure.
Without Angel Reese. But, and keep in mind also, Caitlin Clark played in the most watched men's or women's college basketball game on Fox this year, too. Multiple times.
Well, I'm saying to go from a 6.9 to a 12.3, it is the rematch aspect of that.
Yeah, no, that helped in the Elite Eight, no doubt. But I don't think the number's going to go down. I think it's going to go up
it's
in the Final Four also.
And as long as she keeps advancing.
The Caitlin Clark effect is real. Is it really going to impact women's college basketball when she's gone?
Well, what's the number?
And is it going to continue next year? That's the question
I have. If it's UConn, South Carolina for the title, what's that number compared to the number we saw in the Elite Eight with LSU and Iowa? Back at it, Wednesday edition, 4 p.m. Eastern, right here at outkick.com/watch.